Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast, the podcast for serious lacrosse players and their supporters to help further their development and navigate their way throughout their lacrosse careers. And now, here are your hosts, New England Lacrosse Journal's Kyle Devitt and Jack Piatelli.
Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Devitt. Alongside me, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Jack Piatelli. Jack, how are we doing?
Doing great. You have a nice Christmas?
It's all right. Christmas is my birthday, so I don't love it. Double presents since I was born. Never had a birthday party in my life, but thanks for bringing it up.
Appreciate it. That's really unfortunate. You never had a birthday. You know, you get robbed on Christmas Day. You only get a few extra presents, and no one really cares. It's your birthday.
Oh, no one cares. I feel so bad for you. It's cool. Now you realize why I'm angry all the time, though, right?
Yeah. Now I get it.
It stems from that.
But
we have an incredible guest today. We are kicking off a series on recruiting. We're talking D1, D2, D3, players' perspective, parents. We're going to have coaches on here. And our first guest is someone that we found out both worked for and with in the lacrosse industry, Harvard head coach Jerry Byrne.
Yeah, Jerry brings a lot of energy to the position, head coach at Harvard, but he's been around the game for a very long time. At St. A's with Hugh, you were his assistant coach. He was at Notre Dame as the defensive coordinator. So he has a lot of experience, and now as a Division I head coach at Harvard, in terms of the recruiting process, what he looks for, what the expectations are for players. So I'm really looking forward to having a conversation with Jerry.
Can't wait to talk to him, so we're not going to wait anymore.
Let's go.
Harvard Lacrosse, Jerry Byrne. All right, thanks for joining us. We have a man in the studio that basically needs no introduction if you're familiar with New England lacrosse or lacrosse kind of in general, especially Division I and now the Ivy League, Harvard head coach Jerry Byrne.
Welcome. Good morning, guys. Excited to be here.
Very exciting. Jack, you guys worked together for a while.
We did. We had the opportunity to work at Bryan. Jerry was actually technically my boss. It was a great experience back in the day. Things are much different now than they were then in terms of the lacrosse industry, but we had a great experience working for the Bryan family.
And ironically, also my boss at one time. We coached together at St. A's in New Hampshire, where you lived. You coached Sauhegan before that, right? Sauhegan High School?
I did. So when you're almost 60 years old, you know, you're connected to everybody. Jack, you know, is still 39, and you might be 38 at this point. But, yeah, when you've been around for a long time, you're pretty connected, and lacrosse is one of those sports that you're always one degree of Kevin Bacon from everyone.
Yeah, there's no, I mean, as big as it is and as nuanced and there's everybody from everybody, someone knows somebody. We were talking actually before we started recording that one of the most annoying things about lacrosse is everyone lists off, this is my coach and this is the coach and I know this guy and I know this guy and I played here and you played here. And it's always better to just skip over that and get right to it.
Thanks, everyone, for helping me get here. We'll keep it nice and short.
Nice acceptance speech to start off the podcast.
You've been around the game for a long, long time, and you were at Notre Dame, you were at St. A's, now you're at Harvard. You obviously have a lot of experience with the recruiting process. You do a lot of speaking in terms of the lacrosse process. What is the most important thing that you can tell our audience when, in terms of the recruiting process for the parents?
Well, you know, I think the interesting thing is that, you know, I have three kids, and two of my children went through this process. And I think my perspective on it, you know, prior to my kids becoming of age to be recruited, to, you know, their recruitment and their college experience, is that I think, you know, my perspective was always, you know, respect for the parents. And I developed that watching my kids go through it, because the parents are investing so much time and money and energy into the process that I think younger coaches don't have that. Until you're a parent and you've sat on a sideline and had that anxiousness and that anxiety that comes with watching your kids compete, you can't really understand it. And even though I do this for a living, I went through the same emotions that a lot of parents did. So coming from that view of things, my advice, you know, it's not just one thing, but my advice to parents is that let your kids lead, that it has to be their thing. It has to be their passion. And, you know, as parents, aren't my generation of parents, my dad, I only recognized my dad basically from the forehead up because he was reading, you know, Newsday on Long Island and smoking a butt. And he just, you know, hey, live your life, do as well as you can. It'll work out. You'll figure it out. And I think the next generation of parents, my generation, were so much more involved. And there were times where I wish I could get hit with a shovel and have my dad's laissez-faire view of the world, but I didn't. And so this generation of parents and the next generation is so involved in trying to curate their kids' success at times, which is not a bad emotion. You want your kids to be successful. And there's so many people out there saying, oh, your kids need to learn how to fail and things, which is 100% true. But it doesn't mean as a parent you don't are not trying to be there to soften that blow. But, you know, my advice to parents is let the kids lead. Make sure it's their passion. Because if it's their passion, they'll do the work early in the morning. They'll be thrown against the wall late at night. And they will find their own level, whether it's MCLA club or Division III, Division II, Division I. The higher the division you go, the more competitive it is. And you may want that, and they may want that, but the coaches are ultimately the market makers, and we make mistakes as much as everybody else. You know, there's some really good players in Division II and Division III that can play at Harvard and other programs like that. So let them lead. The market will determine where they fit, and make sure it's their passion.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you point that out, because I'm not a parent, and you both in studio, so I get to flip this on you a little bit. You both have had children that have played Division I lacrosse. And you're saying that, like, you're right. I can't understand what it's like to have, you know, my offspring go through that. But what was the most challenging part of that for both of you?
Interesting, because I think the most challenging part for me was with my youngest son, because my daughter ended up at Endicott, and she very passionate about the game, but she wanted a smaller school and play Division III lacrosse because she knew that that was the right place for her. And that's the other thing. You as a parent, I didn't have any expectations for my kids.
Yeah,
you know, they all played everything: baseball, basketball, soccer, hockey. And they just gravitated to lacrosse, and they're all passionate about it. But back when my youngest son was being recruited, he wasn't being recruited, but he was in the eighth grade. A number of his friends were committing to Division I programs. And, like, he's getting all worked up. I'm like, Dad, am I going to get recruited? I said, listen, relax. I said, it's a long process. Control what you can control. Focus on your studies. Focus on having fun, and everything will work out. And I thought my youngest would probably end up at maybe a NESCAC or a Division III high academic school. And, you know, he just ended up at Cornell. But you can't have any expectations, I don't think, as a parent. Right. Jerry?
You know, I think the hardest thing for a parent is watching your kids compete as their level of skill goes up and they're playing in these tournaments and they are, you know, you're watching your kid. And you know, at the same time as you're watching your child play, that there's, depending on the event, there's 50 college coaches sitting in a $10 chair getting way too much sun. And sometimes they look at your phone while your son does
right
some unbelievably great play. I've gotten emails and texts from parents saying, my son scored 3 goals this game. You were looking at your phone and happened to be looking down when he made this play. And I don't judge them, because I know what it's like to sit on that sideline as a parent and as a recruiter. So the hardest thing for parents is the hope that your children are going to make all the plays, and maybe not being practical or rational enough to realize that's not going to happen. But that's really human. And so when I sit on the sidelines with the parents, and I sometimes listen to young coaches kind of, you know, complain about, you know, the parents cheering for their kids or having unrealistic expectations, I think to myself quietly, because, you know, I'm trying to get nicer as I get older, is like, what do you know? You're not a parent. You're not sitting there with that anxiety and that hope that your son makes all the saves or scores all the goals or gets all these points mm-hmm. in a game. So somebody like me will notate that in their book. And so I think that's the hardest thing as a parent is watching your kids not be perfect, even though you know in your mind they're not going to play a perfect game. And if they play an imperfect game at the game where the three of the prime target schools are there and you don't do well, man, that's got to be hard. So that's why I come back to accepting the fact that they're going to be imperfect, that we're also imperfect in our job, that we don't have a crystal ball. We can't predict the future. I've been doing this for a long time, and I don't think I've gotten better at it just because I've done it 1,000 times. And so I have a lot of empathy for parents because I've gone through it myself.
Yeah, it's so I will say you do have a little bit of a laissez-faire about you. I don't know if you remember this. Pierre was playing in a league that I was coaching in when he was younger, and he wouldn't tie his shoe. And I was like, Pierre, we gotta stop. We gotta tie your shoe. And I looked at you. You were like in the box. We were in the sports center in Bedford, and you were like, and I was like, hey, you want to? And he was like, you were like, no, it's fine. He'll figure it out. I mean, he was like 12, but it was like such a moment for me to like realize like, oh, all right, well, he wants to like, you know, him to learn that. And then, you know, I was kind of out of covering that for a little bit. I went into coaching kind of full time. When I came back, Pierre's at Notre Dame. And I'm like, Pierre's at Notre Dame. He didn't even tie his shoe. You know what I mean? Like, it's just so funny to me that like that's how that progression happens. And because, again, I didn't go through it as a parent, but seeing how kids go from that state where in eighth grade and then within 2 years, they're getting recruited now. That has to be one of the most challenging things, not only just for the kid, but for the parents and for coaches to get it right with the evaluation has to be one of the most, I mean, how do you know?
The changing of the rules that limited recruiting for the young players, so, you know, Jack was alluding to eighth graders committing, that created this, you know, the anxiety went off the roof because, you know, the advent of social media, right. the self-promotion that came from basketball and football about who's recruiting me and pictures of you know, at the front gates of schools or photos with, you know, the school you're visiting's uniform on. The advent of that kind of bled into lacrosse that led to eighth graders committing, which led to the question that, you know, Jack was having with his kids, which is, all right, well, shouldn't I? I'm good too, or I scored more goals than that guy in the last event. How come I'm not recruited? Instead of, hey, being in your backyard working on your shot or being on the wall or playing pickup with your friends, you were worried about performing instead of improving. Mm-hmm. And that's what led to kind of the changing of the rules. But all it did was really kind of delay some of that anxiety to September 1st. But your observation is, how do you go from an eighth grader who, you know, doesn't tie his shoes and doesn't make his bed and hasn't taken a high school class? How can that guy be committed to an elite school to, you know, 3 years later, they're shaving and driving and, yeah, you know, going on dates. And yeah, it gets a little strange, but you can totally see how that anxiety between a 14, 15-year-old, their parents who've invested time and energy and want their kids to be successful, they're seeing people in their community, maybe on their same club or high school team, making a decision. You're like, what does this mean for me? And I think some really good players, and you know, in my past professional life, some of the best players I've ever recruited have been the last guys in a class who somehow have been able to maintain effort and work and be in the shadows, you know, not, you know, they're out there working saying, hey, I don't care that guy committed in eighth grade. I'm going to be better than him. And so, yeah, the romantic side of you in recruiting is really hunting for those guys.
Yeah.
Jerry, I think my experience too, watching a lot of high school games over the years and, you know, being in the club world, if a player is on a good club team, they win a lot of games, or, you know, their high school team wins the state tournament and two or three kids are going to Division I schools, a lot of parents have that perception because you're on a good team and there are three players going to play Division I lacrosse. Why isn't my son going to play Division I lacrosse? Well, he's on the same team. They won all the games. They won the state tournament. He's a starter, but they're not all Division I players.
Well, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, you know. So I think that is something that parents cannot forget, that it's this is art and science and luck and magic and timing. There's so many variables that go into it. And now there's hundreds of club teams. There's hundreds of events to feed the club teams. You're not sure which is the chicken or the egg. Is it the event or the clubs? And we, you know, at our level, we only have three coaches that can be out on the road consistently. So we can't be everywhere. So I think the programs that do it well are methodical around the recommendations that they get, the organization of their schedule, the tracking of data, the, you know, how they crowdsource all the information, the recommendations that they get, the notes that they take in an event, second and third hand insight. You keep this kind of chronology of information that you get, and that helps kind of paint the picture of where, how you might see somebody. But then ultimately it becomes that you're watching. And for me, that's, you know, I have great assistants and Ted Bergman and Neil Hutchinson and Will Corrigan. Neil's my head assistant. That all that information is funneled to me, and then ultimately we'll go and watch and make some decisions based on what we see. But even with all of that analysis, you make some mistakes. And, you know, the thing you don't want to make mistake in is character. And that's a harder one to learn about. You have to dig deep. You have to talk to guidance counselors. You got to talk to the other sport coaches. You got to talk to the assistant position coach who works with a young man every day. And so you don't want to make character mistakes. You make talent mistakes consistently, but ultimately that's the coach's error. That's not the player's mm-hmm. error. You made an assessment. You made an offer. And so it's imperfect. It is. Anybody who tells you that they figured it out is, they're full of you know what. Because yeah. I think that's the mystery of it. So identifying talent is one step. Evaluating character and how that character and the talent work together is another step. Then they arrive. This is where the coach is the manager. He's the inspirer. He's the one that points a path and helps pull more out of that guy. That's where, you know, the coach and his staff become critical. Are you pointing a way for this player to really evolve, this young man as a person as well?
I think one of the other situations, misconceptions in the recruiting process, you know, we talked about how it changed now. Coaches at the Division I level can now actually start talking to their recruits the fall of their junior year, September 1st. But a lot of players and parents have the perception that September 1st of their junior year is the signing day, but it's just the beginning of the recruiting process. You've got, you know, your top maybe 25 players in the country. Your blue chippers might get offers on September 1st, but you're still recruiting players for, you know, this class. It's just the beginning, and I think it's very important for parents to understand that.
Yeah, you know, I think when you look at September 1st, it's like the Oklahoma land rush. They blow a horn and everybody goes out and they try to plant their flag. Sometimes it's the school that has, here's the 10 or 11 guys that we would like, and they're going to full bore, full court press, go and get some of those guys. And they're married with some percentage of the top 100 players, if you presume that you can rank the top 100 players. Some of them want to go to that school that loves them. So that's why it happens really quickly. Sometimes, you know, Johnny and school X were meant to be. Maybe it's a family connection, or it's a geographic, or maybe the scholarship, if it's a scholarship program, that all fits in. So that happens in the first, like, 2 weeks of September, where certainty on the coach's side meets interest and desire on the other side. And it just happens. And then there's usually a lull at the end of September that happens, where this kind of, you know, whether it's someone who's taken their time or a player that maybe wasn't in the same tier as some other players, and then it slows down a little bit. Then it picks up again in November when the November events start happening. And so I just never felt that it was a sprint, just because, you know, having so many really good players that were the, you know, 9th, 10th, 11th player in a recruiting class. And so, you know, everybody does it their own way. Sometimes it's because they have flexibility with admissions. Sometimes it's because they have scholarships. And what parents realize is that there's probably less than 5 people in Division I lacrosse who are going to school on a full scholarship. There's just, if you're a scholarship program, there's 12.6 spread over 50 and sometimes 60 players. So I won't do that long division for you, but there's not a lot of money in college lacrosse, so that's not the gold at the end of the rainbow. So, but scholarship is a real, there's an ego element of that. There's a real financial element too. Like, parents need, you know, need that relief so their son can go to a certain school. Some want the scholarship for validation of all the time and effort that they put on those club teams and the effort that they put on in their backyard. It doesn't make them bad people, but I think, you know, within reason, schools are very expensive, and it's really hard, even for an affluent family. You're talking about schools that are $60,000 or $70,000, $80,000 now. Anything that's a relief to that is, you know, even if it is ego, is really practical, because, you know, affording a great school that your son wants to go to or your daughter wants to go to is really, it must be intimidating. That's another part for me. Like, I have so much empathy for parents, because you want your, not only do you want your son or daughter to be successful, you also want to be able to give them this thing that you've been saving for. And, you know, thinking about those dinner conversations, how stressful that may be between parents figuring out we're going to do a second mortgage, or, you know, do we sell our, you know, get rid of that second car, or, you know, our third son can't go to the private school, and because we're trying to save it for Johnny to go to, you know, the college that he wants. Like, that's what people, I think, really need to understand, is that the stress of that must be overwhelming. I have a lot of understanding, and because I've been in the middle of that myself.
I think it's also, you know, talking about numbers, there are less than 80 Division I teams. There are 50, I guess I would say probably minimum for D1 squads, players on each team, right? Each class for each school is only going to be at the max 8 to 10 kids. So maybe a little more, maybe 12 occasionally, but if you're bringing in all those kids, like, not everyone's going to play. Not everyone's going to make the team, even. Like, there are still kids that go to schools to get cut, you know? And I think, you know, I'm sure that you probably deal with that at Harvard, and people, like, probably try to, like, get in when maybe they can't get in, you know? And I think that struggle, too, for parents, as well as the tension between parents and coaches, is a huge part of recruiting. So how do you, you know, reconcile that? What is your process for going through that? I know you're talking about the struggle of that and meeting the needs of the parent and also the player. But as the coach, like, what do you need?
My philosophy on that, and it was formed Coach Corrigan, this was Coach Corrigan's mentality as well, is that if you recruited a player to your school, that you did not cut them. That if they weren't good enough, then you made that mistake.
Right.
You know, if they arrive and they're not good enough, that was a failure of our assessment and things like that. And so, you know, if they have character issues or values issues or social activity issues, that may affect their membership in the community. But I've never cut anyone based on skill. You know, I think we as an organization coaches need to be transparent about that. There's, whether you're a new program or you're a new coach and you're trying to transition to a new culture, it's very tempting to clean house and do some of that, because listen, your livelihood is on the line, your career is on the line. Maybe you only have a 2 or 3 year contract and you need to try to make improvements so you get the next contract and don't get fired during that process. So part of that is also a relationship between the head coach and the athletic director. But within that community that you're trying to build, you have you know, academic performance, you have social and community responsibilities, you obviously have your skill development and your training. Everyone values all of those things, but I think there's a, you know, whether it's the size of rosters now or the ruthlessness around cutting people who have been recruited, the decision to go to a school, there has to be more than just a lacrosse piece. If right. all you went for that, then it becomes easy to say, you know, I'm coming back home. I'm cutting bait, and I'm not going to play here. Or the coach made it clear that I'm not going to be a contributor. And so that there's a responsibility on the coaches and the coach staff to communicate the full scope of what a school can offer. But it's also a responsibility for the parents and the kids to think about: does it have my major? Are they going to allow me to be pre-med and be an athlete? You know, engineering, architecture, whatever really demanding majors. And so, but there's also a realism that young people have to have, which is they never think they're going to be the player who doesn't play.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, as a coach, you're, you know, I try to be really realistic about what we say to guys. I never say, oh my God, you're going to be a three-time All-American, or you're going to be, I don't promise anything. Anybody promises you anything, is you should see that as a line, because you don't know the competition in your own recruiting class. They're recruiting, you know, the class ahead of you had really good players too. They're already recruiting the class behind you. Know that you're going to compete. And I think that is the critical thing for any guys, is know that you're coming into a place that you're going to compete. And so, but parents and kids all think that they're going to be,
right,
they're going to be the star. That, well, if only half your team plays, you're in a game, 23 to 25 people play, and there's 50, 60 players on some teams now, is you might not be the one. Are you still there? Do you feel valued? Are you part of the culture? Do you feel engaged? Are you studying what you want? Are you still working? That's, you know, that's harder to predict, but it's hard to have that conversation with a 16-year-old.
Right.
Because, no, that's someone else who's not going to play, not me.
Yeah, well, it's also kind of bleeding into lacrosse, right? Like other sports, you see now the transfer portal is a big deal in Division I lacrosse and in all divisions of lacrosse. It's a huge part of the college process now. And you've seen in college football, you know, a guy doesn't play, he's a quarterback, and they just leave. They're like, oh, I'm not going to play this year or next year, I'm out. And in lacrosse, you can do that now too. So how has that changed the recruiting process for you? And you talk a lot about character guys like that. When you see a guy flip their commitment, I mean, maybe it's not related to you, but you see it somewhere else. What is your thought on that as a coach?
Well, there's two things in your question. One is around the portal, and one of them is around people ultimately executing their right to go to the school that they want to go right. to. And I'm a libertarian in that way, meaning I went to college already. I believe that 16 to 17-year-olds can choose where they want to go. I believe a 21-year-old who decides to transfer. I think it's funny when people are talking about the transfer portal that, you know, they're maligning, oh, they can't deal with this generation, can't deal with disappointment. Or, I'm like, first of all, you don't know what that situation is. Maybe they don't like their team. Maybe their locker room isn't great. Maybe their, you know, his relationship with the coach is. Maybe he really wants to play. Maybe he can go to another place and play and study what he wants to do. Like, it's so easy to go on these platforms and make these, you know, malign these young people for transferring, presuming that, oh, he's leaving because he's not playing yet. That might be true. And even if it is true, what's wrong with that? And so, you know, pursue your own happiness. If that means you go to school X from school Y, that doesn't make you a terrible person. That just means you're trying to pursue that. And you don't make it to any sort of college level by being soft, that you've worked hard to get to the XYZ school of the world, and now you want to go to ABC school, go for it. I think it's that argument, that trope of, oh, they're soft, they don't like disappointment, that, yeah, obviously I don't feel passionate about it at all. And I think it transitions to, you know, people getting to change their mind. That I don't think, you know, someone who commits to Harvard, he's not making a blood oath to me. I didn't slice my hand with a knife and shake hand and we're bound for life. My job as the coach is to continue to give compelling reasons why this should be the only place that you consider. And do I worry that if we lose a game that someone's going to feel less strongly about our program? Yeah, a little bit, but I don't worry about it because I know I'm continuing to give reasons about the academic support, the career development. This is most programs are doing this. It's not unique to Harvard, is that I'm continuing to give reasons why would I think about going anywhere else? But if someone does decide to decommit from Harvard, the first place I look is myself in the mirror, which is I didn't do what I vowed to do, which was continue to give compelling reasons. But even if I did everything right, my assistants did everything right, I think it's that person's right, that 16 and 17-year-old, their parents' right to say they want to go to school closer, or they want to go to a different school, or you know what, Harvard became too expensive and they needed to go to school X now because it was closer, or they had a family emergency, dad lost his job, mom is sick, whatever it is, I start looking at myself and how do I do it better in the future. I don't think that's a character issue. I think that's they have the right, just like someone in the portal has a right to choose where he wants to go.
New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal will return after this message. Catch the Sacred Heart University Pioneers on the ice this season. The Pioneers Division I men and women's hockey programs will not disappoint. Season ticket packages and individual tickets are on sale now at sacredheartpioneers.com. An opening in 2023, Sacred Heart University's Martiri Family Arena, a brand new 122,000 square foot premier skating facility in Fairfield, Connecticut. Learn more at sacredheartpioneers.com.
Are you serious about playing your sport in college? Do you need a flexible education that allows you to maintain your practice and competition schedules while also preparing you to succeed at the next level? You should check out the University of Nebraska High School. UNHS is accredited and offers more than 100 online courses, including NCAA-approved courses to protect your academic eligibility. Students could earn a UNHS diploma or take a single course for transfer credit. Courses are college prep, self-paced, and available 24/7, 365. Enroll anytime and take up to a year to complete a course. Visit highschool.nebraska.edu today.
Looking to keep up with all the latest news and information on New England lacrosse? New England Lacrosse Journal and LaxJournal.com are the premier resources for information and inspiration on the New England lacrosse scene. Have every issue of New England Lacrosse Journal, the magazine, delivered to your home or office. And don't forget to stay in the game every day with a digital subscription to LaxJournal.com to receive daily digital lacrosse coverage on club lacrosse, college commits, prep and high school, Division I, II, and III colleges, showcases, rankings, and much more. Get in the game and behind the scenes now by logging on to LaxJournal.com. Just click on the subscribe button and start the subscription that is right for you today. New England Lacrosse Journal is a Siemens Media publication. Siemens Media. Inspiring. Informative. Insightful.
Jerry, I had a player come up to me once, ask me, a high school player, how do I get nationally ranked? And I said, I really don't know how you get nationally ranked in the top 100 as a player. And I wouldn't focus on getting ranked as a player. I would focus on what you can do for yourself, and that's continue to make yourself better in the classroom and make yourself better as a player. As a coach, do you take a look at those rankings? And what are your thoughts on the rankings nationally at the high school level?
You know, the rankings are kind of an offshoot of, you know, the world that we live in. Now, it was no different than, you know, 40 years ago when people ranked the 10 hottest guys in Hollywood. You know, it's just, it's an easy way to sell magazines back in the 80s. You know, I never made the list, in case you were worried. You know, it's just a way now, instead of selling magazines, it's clickbait, and people want to see where they fit or who made it and who do they know. So, I don't think it's bad business. I think there's an element of starting conversations with people. Obviously, some of those conversations get angry on social media or face-to-face, and you can see it in some of the tension on the sidelines at some of these tournaments, not because it's about rankings, but the fields are so tight and it's so hot, and there might be some solo cups on the sideline too. Is that all of that is creating, kind of coming back to the anxiety that some of the kids and the parents feel. But, you know, the rankings, I think, is smart business. If I'm running a website and a magazine, I think that's a great way to start some conversations. I think they probably get that stuff 50% right, you know, which is, you know, what is what you'd kind of imagine. I'm very interested in the guys who aren't on those lists, who are in the basement with that list, you know, on their mirror doing pull-ups and hang cleans and curls in their basement, you know, mumbling the name of the guy who's ranked ahead of them or the guy from their club team who's getting more stroke or, you know, some high school, you know, rival. That guy's I'm really interested about. And again, coming back to a similar point, some of those guys have been some of the great players I've ever coached. And so whether they're too small or they came from a bad high school or didn't play on a sexy club team, those guys who are chewing on a 45-pound plate in the basement gym of their house, I'm hunting that guy.
It's funny being on the other side of that. The media in lacrosse is smaller than anyone knows. I really don't even want to tell you how small it is. Our network is very small. We all talk to each other. And sometimes, you know, I get the odd, what do you think of this kid? All the time. And I'm like, pretty good is usually like my answer. Like, pretty good. Well, where would you rank him? I'm like, I don't really want to do rankings, because then, like, you put your name on it, you stamp the kid, you know, and that's a big part of doing the rankings. And college coaches are a big part of the rankings, right? Because they're the ones who get asked, and they're the ones whose opinions ultimately matter, because that is who is going to recruit the kid, right? Regardless. And the list doesn't legitimize you, is the thing. I wish that players, and hopefully if you're a player and you're listening to this, the list does not legitimize you. Your work legitimizes you. And the thing that, again, I get sent tape, I get sent emails, I get sent all this stuff just because I'm in the media. I'm not even part of a national media anymore, but I'll still get, hey, what do you think of this kid? And sometimes it's coaches, sometimes it's parents, sometimes it's the kid. And you're kind of have to handle it a different way. When you get sent a tape from a kid or someone, you know, gets a hold of you for a direct inquiry, how do you handle that? What is your process for handling that?
You know, I think, but to riff on what you said is that, you know, we look at the rankings, to your question, Jack, right, and we'll look at them. We'll do our own assessment of them. And like I said, they're, you know, 50, 60% right in that moment.
Right.
You know, because just like, you know, if they have a small group that's doing that assessment, they can't be everywhere. And if we can't be everywhere to really give a true rankings, then it's, you know, it's imperfect, like most rankings are. And as Kyle was saying, there's a lot of college coaches who are feeding those rankings. And if they know that they're going to get, you know, Joe Smith, guess what? Joe Smith's going to be ranked really high in their mind. And so, yeah, the objectivity of the rankings is suspect at best. But we look at them. There's value in it. You know, whether we send questionnaires to everybody who's on that list, we'll do that assessment. So it is helpful. It's directional. It helps us kind of form out into the future some of the people that we should be considering. As far as when I get video from players, you know, I'm a good Catholic, well, relatively good Catholic, is that I worry about if I miss a guy, like, so whether it's myself, mostly my assistants now who are doing the filtering, and they'll do the assessment. If they forward it on to me, it's something that they think is really interesting. If it comes to me directly, I watch it. And you quickly kind of do a skim of grades and where they play, are their coaches referenced in the email, and then you watch the video. And you are trying to get, but it's hard to assess on video because you don't always get a sense of who they're playing, the quality of, you know, they don't tell you who they're playing against, and now you're starting to play Name That Helmet. You're like, oh, I think that's Ward Melville. I'm not sure. Or is that some other school? And so it's imperfect in that way. The guys who do their videos really well tell you who they are, by circling or highlighting themselves, they'll tell you who they're playing, and they give you an idea of like, hey, I have a ground ball into an assist here. So I don't have to play kind of CSI Cambridge and trying to figure out which guy are you in this video. And so, but I watch them all. My assistants really scrutinize them, and they kind of help filter them. And then we watch. And then if they have a level of interest, they get a questionnaire. We don't send a lot of questionnaires out. We're trying to manage our database tightly. And then we go to collecting academic, more detailed academic, more detailed film and references. But I do worry about missing a guy.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
So basically, you almost watch all the film yourself as well as your assistants.
Assistants first, then me.
Double check. Follow-up question, length of the videos, what do you like to see in the length? And what about the music?
Well, oh, I think the music drives the video length, you know. I don't think you want to have Freebird on there unless you have 14 minutes of highlights. You know, I'm a hip-hop guy. I like all kinds of music. I think there's so much attention to the video editing now that, you know, there's some great hit or some great pass comes on the beat on the break. So, you know, I think my philosophy on video has changed. I think that if you have a 2 to 3 minute kind of setup, and then I want to see kind of the exposition of your game over time. If you're not in that group where there's certainty, we were talking about that early September group. If you're not in that group, and that group is really 20 to 30 people, which means the other 90% of all Division I recruits are in the other universe, is that keep on telling me a story. Keep on showing, you know, if you have a 2 to 3 minute overall highlight, pull me in. Tell me a story. The music obviously really, really counts. A little Eric B. and Rakim, a little, you know, a little old school hip hop always gets my attention. But then maybe in late September, you send me a writing, 60 seconds of you writing. And then, you know, 2 weeks after that, 60 seconds of you clearing. You playing off-ball offense, off-ball defense. Now, you're pulling me in. It's like a movie trailer, and every time I get something from you, I'm gonna be a little bit more intrigued versus coming in with the three-hour avatar, you know, director's cut. And that can be really long.
I feel like the thing that everyone does is like, oh, I have to have my sickest highlights. My friend's going to shoot me. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're going to have this be my tape. And we're going to do all those things that you said. But the thing that struck me about what you just said was show me moving off ball. Show me riding. Show me getting a ground ball. Show me fighting for something out of the box. Show me, you know, taking a big hit, giving a big hit, yeah. Something like that. I wish that every player listening to this would do that, because that is what coaches look for. You know, like, I think kids just want to do flash, 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 flash all the way through.
Totally.
And it's not what's happening.
You get the scroll at the start of it, like Star Wars, and you're like, all right, I was 79 and 32 last year. I'm like, holy moly, that's a lot of points. It's 111 points, I think. I just did that math in my head. Then they proceed to show you all 73 goals. Like, just give me the...
Yeah.
You know, just give me the flavor of everything. And now, if I can establish that because of the quality of the opponents in your film and endorsements, like if you don't include your, like if you play at XYZ school, the first thing, if I like your video or we got a good recommendation, I'm gonna go look at those references. I can't tell you how many times I get references. I'm like, well, I know John Smith is the head coach at XYZ school. John Smith is not on this thing. John Smith is the first phone call.
Yeah.
Like, we know who these people are. So when you don't include the obvious person, it means there's something there,
yeah,
that you don't want us to know. We're gonna find out. But I think showing the range of skill, like once you've established, all right, that guy can dodge and that guy can feed or that guy can cover or that guy can save, we'll stipulate that. What are some of these other things? Like defensively, I don't need to see a defenseman running with the ball, because if I need you to clear the ball, we're a terrible clearing team. Yeah. I need to see you cover guys, need to see you slide, need to see you not slide, need to see you scoop and escape. I don't need to see you, like, if we have defensemen scoring, that means we're a terrible offensive field team.
Yeah, I think one of the things I remember, we didn't have a ton of meetings at St. A's about recruiting, and I didn't do a lot of recruiting there. I just – kind of helped on the sidelines and stuff. One of the things you said is when you first started recruiting, when you were first coaching, you wrote down an adjective about a kid and you said reactionary. And you gave it back to the coach. The coach was like, what is this? What does this mean? This doesn't mean anything. What is he, a revolutionary? What does this mean? I don't understand what this is. You can, don't write stuff like this, right? Tell me what he can do. Tell me what he can't do. You know, and I think that's kind of good advice, not just for coaches, but for, you know, parents. I mean, parents can't really evaluate their kids without bias, right? So how do you, as a player, if you're listening to this, or if a parent is you're listening to this, how do you apply that logic to where you are? So I think the most common question I get, and I'm not even a coach. I mean, I am a high school coach, but the most common question I get is my kid a D3 player or a D1 player? How do I tell the difference? And that's why when we do this podcast, I literally ask almost every coach that question, because there's not one answer. There's a million answers.
Well, and this is a great thing to not wrap up, but to kind of tie it all together, is that the question and the answers change. Like,
yeah,
evaluating somebody in June that might, like, and this happens to me dozens of times in my college career, someone that you kind of liked in June, then all of a sudden all sorts of recruiting, other people commit to other schools, blah, 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 and you get to the end of July and you love a guy because his game developed over the summer, and relative to the palette of what is left, or your class is starting to come together, man, you really need a D-middy who can play early offense. And that's that guy. So the question is, hey, am I a Division I or Division I player in June? Might not be answered to the end of July or maybe in November.
Right.
And so, and the people who get to decide that is not your parents. It's not your high school coach. It's not your club coach. It's the imperfect guys like me sitting in those chairs all summer and all fall, trying to use our own crystal ball to predict that. And and I'm telling you that it's not a perfect science, process, art, luck, magic, all the stuff I alluded to earlier. But those questions and those answers do change over time. You know, you might get a question in the third week of September, coach, you have, you know, 3 or 4 commits already. You have 2 players at attack left. And how many people are you recruiting? Well, you're one of 3 people that we're looking at. And you know, hopefully coaches give honest feedback like that. And you know, we're going to watch you in November. So you kind of know where you sit. But in that next 2 weeks, if those other 2 guys decide to go to other places, now you're the hot. Now you're one. Yep. You're one of one. And so the marketplace shifts. And so you hear a lot of things about, oh, this coach lied to me. I don't think inherently coaches are lying. It's just the truth shifts from, yeah, you know, 3 weeks later, you get a different answer. Yeah. So you need to keep on asking. When you're a parent, you need to keep on asking the same questions, because the answer may change, not because the coach is lying, just because the marketplace and the timing and the composition of all the recruiting has changed.
Yeah.
The little intangibles you talked about in the video, I'm going to go back to that for a sec, but one of the greatest players ever played the position, attack, Mike Powell, was one of the best riders to ever play the position, and it was his favorite part of the game. And Jerry, you know this, it's the little things, the ground balls, the toughness, the little intangibles that the players need to provide on their videos. The last question I had for you was, how important is it for you or the player where they come from in terms of their high school when you recruit them? Is there value in what high school they're playing at, or is it just it's not so much about where you play, it's how you play?
You know, I think 15 years ago, that if you asked that question, people would be like, oh, we got to recruit Long Island, we got to recruit Central New York, you know, and Baltimore. And you were pretty safe there because there was a safety, a presumption of safety, that they play against other good competition. You assume they're getting good coaching. They don't play a lot of bad teams. And I think the answer now is that most coaches really don't care. I know I don't care. Because you're looking to be struck. You want to fall in love. You don't want to fall into like. And so when you're watching, if you let the club helmet or the high school helmet skew, you start, you know, business to call it the halo effect. I start assuming if I recognize a certain high school, I make assumptions about that guy that may not be true just because, I recognize his helmet and I know he's coached by Joe Smith and Joe Smith has produced a lot of good players and that may not be true for that guy. So as much as you can, I try to take myself out of that. I do, you know, when you do recognize the high school, you go dig deep and you start talking to their high school and their club coaches and you try to find out, does he remind you of any of the guys in the pantheon of players that you've ever coached? So you dig deep, but you make an assumption. But you look at, the college programs, most of them have 15 to 20 different states on them. You don't have the same assumptions that you did 15 years ago because your livelihood and your job is not connected to, I got to make that coach on Long Island really happy, so I better recruit his kid. No, you're connected. Can that guy help me? Has he proven through his video, through his event performance, through your interaction with him, that he's your kind of guy, your kind of person, your kind of teammate? And you can't let a club helmet or, a high school helmet skew your objectivity. You have to base it on your facts.
Last question for me. You have to answer yes or no. Do you have to play on a club team to be a Division I player now?
No. I believe it's difficult just because of the reach of the events and the importance of the summer. It's, but you're also seeing the growth of these high school team events. So there's this yin and yang going on. You have club events, which are great and with the club teams, and then you have high school events. They're fighting against each other. And it's forcing some loyalty and allegiance issues. Each of them have value. I don't have any sort of preference. They're both valuable, and there's benefits for both. For on a club team, I can be more of myself. I'm within a structure. We're not practicing all the time. I can be more creative, maybe, and more impulsive. And then on my high school team, because I'm wearing my high school jersey and we're playing against a rival team or another really good program from another area, I'm within a structure. We're playing our offense. We're playing our defense, and scoreboard's on. It's a little bit different. Both have value.
I agree with that.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. I could sit here and talk for another hour for sure, and I'm sure Jack could as well. But we just want to thank you for coming in and kicking this series off as only you could.
Thank you, fellas. We'll look forward to the next one.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for coming in.
When's Harvard's opener?
Harvard's opener, February 19th. Good tickets and seats available.
Against who?
NJIT.
Nice.
Great. Thanks for coming in. Really appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Guys.
Thanks a lot, Jerry.
All right. That was Jerry Byrne. Basically everything I thought it would be and more.
No question about it. He has a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience with the recruiting process and gave our audience, the players, parents, a lot of good information, tips, videos, what you need to do as a player, get better, focus on the intangibles, the little things, the ground balls, the riding. Yep. Very good stuff.
It's always great to have a guest on that is not short on opinions, especially because we aren't. And that's why it's fun to do the podcast. And Jerry couldn't think of a better guest to have on to kick off the recruiting series. And, Harvard's going to be fun to watch. He didn't really big up his program a lot, which is good. I thought he would come in here full on. He's got his own platforms. They're actually coming up in the social ranks with the Ivy League teams. They're raising the bar there. But he just came in. He was all business. He gave us exactly what we wanted. Hopefully you enjoyed listening to it.
It was great having him as a guest. And again, a must listen for sure for the players and parents.
Thanks again for listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. For Jack Piatelli, I'm Kyle Devitt. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Also, listen to the podcast on the website, laxjournal.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at NELaxJournal, Instagram at New England Lacrosse Journal, Lax Journal on Facebook, and our email address, chasingthegoal@laxjournal.com. Join us again next time as we go chasing the goal. Chasing the Goal, a Siemens Media podcast.